This episode of To The Journey is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for smartphone, tablet and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice and help Trek FM at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space, an international programme of the non-profit National Space Society. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter by visiting enterpriseinspace.org. And if you want to join in the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode, join the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type Babel, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the Facebook search field. We look forward to seeing you there.
Hi, this is Robert Duncan McNeil, also known as Tom Paris from Star Trek Voyager. You're listening to Trek FM.
I think it's safe to say that no one on this crew has been more obsessed with getting home than I have. But when I think about everything we've been through together, maybe it's not the destination that matters. Maybe it's the journey. And if that journey takes a little longer, so we can do something we all believe in, I can't think of any place I'd rather be, or any people I'd rather be with.
To the journey.
You're here.
To the journey.
Hello, everybody at home, and welcome. This is To The Journey. I'm your co-host, Zachary Fruling, and with me, as always, is...
Kay Shaw.
Well, today, we are going to be doing a commentary on the sixth season episode, Pathfinder. Or, as you would say, Kay, a commentary.
A commentary, yes.
I really like doing these commentary episodes, Kay, because it's kind of like doing a briefing with Neelix, except it's watching Star Trek with Kay and Zach.
Yeah, I enjoy doing them as well. They are good fun. This is a great episode, actually. It's a real favourite for me, I think. It's a very emotional episode, I think, and there's some really great stuff in here, so I'm looking forward to it.
And if you happen to have a cat named Neelix, you can invite your cat to watch along with you.
Yeah. There's a high chance that I will well up at some point during this episode, because I normally do when I watch this one.
It's interesting. I think you shed more tears in Voyager in general than I do. I think that's interesting.
Just Star Trek. Probably life, to be honest. I'm a crier. I'm a crier everything.
I used to be, but that was before I became jaded and old.
Well, I don't really have any answer to that. Maybe I can imbue you with some of my, you know, youthful weeping today.
We'll see. If the occasion calls for it inside the episode, I will shed a tear here on To The Journey. Aww. So if you haven't listened to one of our commentaries before, we are going to comment on this episode of Star Trek Voyager, Pathfinder. We have the episode queued up, so if you are watching along with us, queue up your Netflix or queue up your DVD. Right at the very beginning, we're going to give a countdown, 3-2-1 play, or 3-2-1 engage, probably, since this is a Star Trek podcast. And when we say play or say engage, hit play, and you'll be generally synced up with us and well-positioned to enjoy our commentary. So let the countdown commence in 3, 2, 1, engage. See, this was so weird. I remember watching this the first time. It was like, what is this? Is this an episode of TNG?
Yeah, I think I remember watching it the first time and wondering what was going on as well and checking what I'd actually put in. I thought, have I got the wrong disc or something? Because it would have been on DVD at the time.
I think generally it's so much fun to see Voyager placed in context of the overall Star Trek
Definitely. Universe.
And we have so much good, positive experience with these characters. It's fun to see the characters again.
Yeah, it really is. I remember being very excited seeing Deanna walk in there because she's somebody I really liked from TNG.
And I really love Reginald Barclay. I have this like hidden fear that I'm really more like Reginald Barclay than I ever let on.
Mine's not a hidden fear. I admit it on a regular basis.
Well, it's funny. Something I realize as I get a little older, like, I'm actually kind of afraid of everything. Yeah. Like, I'm just a kind of a worrier by nature, and I've learned to get over that. But it's actually kind of getting worse. Like, I find as I get older that I'm a little more nervous, a little more anxious about the unknown, a little more, not awkward, but just kind of more of a worrier. And I relate to Barclay. I really do.
Yeah, me too. I have to have a little shout out here for the cameo appearance of chocolate ice cream. I appreciate that.
Have you ever had a cat named after a Star Trek character? I'm just curious because no. I've always kind of been tempted.
No, I haven't. I've always been tempted to name pets after characters from various things, but no, I don't.
See, we thought about naming a cat Tribble at one point, but we didn't go that direction. Yeah.
That would be really good. Do you know, one comment about this scene, actually. Do you always feel like whenever we see people's kind of living quarters on Earth, they're always kind of weirdly industrial?
Well, San Francisco is an old town, right? I mean, it's not old like you get old in Europe. It's not old like New York old, but it's relatively old. There are a lot of old buildings there, and it does have this kind of, especially 20 years ago, before it was all renovated with the tech industry, it did kind of have this like old industrialist, early 20th century kind of look to it. And you could rent a loft or a flat that looks just like this.
Oh, okay. So maybe it's a San Francisco thing, and that's why I'm not getting it.
That's it, exactly. I'm British. This is absolutely a San Francisco thing. And I love this idea that the San Francisco-ness of San Francisco has persisted
Neelix,
into
off the
24th
ice cream.
Century. Neelix is one big, fluffy white cat in this.
Yeah, I'm not sure if I was going to do... If I was going to have a cat and call it Neelix, I think it would have to be orange, surely.
It would have to have fuzzy ears and sideburns.
It would have to be orange as well.
I would think so.
Yeah. You need a great big fluffy orange tomcat to be a Neelix.
It must be hard to act with a cat, actually. Yeah. You have to have this cat that's gentle enough and mellow enough just to chill with whatever you're doing. Like here, it just has to sit here and... It doesn't look like it wants to be held, actually.
No, it wants to get back to the chocolate ice cream.
He's gripping that cat pretty
tightly.
Give
me the ice cream!
So I love this scene right here when he says, I've lost myself in Voyager. Yes. Because this hits home so much. You know, we're all of us yeah. Voyager fans, I think, are in danger of losing ourselves and our sense of real life for the sake of, you know, being involved in this fictional world. And I think this hits kind of close to home. And it definitely is putting the mirror back at Voyager fans.
Yeah, oh, it did. I'm sure that's what it's supposed to be. I remember seeing this for the first time, and I talked a little bit about this when I was on Standard Orbit the other week, and I talked about how I came into Voyager having not watched much Star Trek for quite a few years. And Voyager really sort of gave me back my love for Star Trek, and I remembered how much of an anorak I'd been as a kid and just loved TNG and just had everything about TNG and couldn't stop talking about it. And I got properly obsessed with it to the point where all my friends were just like, they didn't even want to talk to me anymore. They were all like unfollowing me on Facebook because they were bored of me talking about Star Trek. and when this quote came up, I put it on Facebook and I was like, Barclay is just... channeling me at this point.
Well, I think there's a fine line between escapism and therapeutic watching, right? So I often watch Voyager to kind of self-soothe. Like, I'll put it on to relax in the evening, just kind of decompress and wind. It's like my little family time, because the Voyager characters are very much like a little family. Even in my mind, they're like my little extended family.
Yeah.
They're the family I wish I had. But there's a fine line between that and escapism, like not dealing with real life and losing yourself in fantasy.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. But yeah, I did get a bit crazy there for a while. I really like this. I know Suzanne always talks about how much she likes it when the nacelles go up and stuff, but it is great.
Yeah, I wish we'd seen a little more. I mean, I guess they kept doing it. They just stopped drawing attention to it at a certain point.
Yeah, yeah. So now we get the
obligatory Counselor Troy counseling session. So some people... have claimed that Counselor Troy is a better counselor here than she was in The Next Generation. Do you find that to be true?
Yeah, I do, actually. I think I really do. I think we have an episode planned that's coming up where we're going to talk about Troy on Voyager, so I think we can get really into the depths of that. But yeah, I definitely think there's something there.
Well, Troy, as compassionate as she is, keeps a professional distance most of the time. And here, she's clearly talking to Barclay as a friend, not so much as a patient of hers. Like, the line has become blurred.
Yes, but I still think she does a good job of maintaining that kind of counselor sort of... I don't know what the word is I'm trying to come up with.
Demeanor.
Yeah.
Detachment?
Still
it's not detached.
No,
detached
it's not
here.
Detachment, but she's still got her counselor hat on very much, is what I think I'm trying to say, even though she's probably doing it in a slightly more familiar way than she normally would do.
I love that the trouble with Barkley always starts in the holodeck.
Well, it starts
on the holodeck. Oh, really, Barkley?
Come on, you're not telling me that if you had a holodeck, it wouldn't be...
Oh, I'd be. I'd lose myself.
Yeah,
in Voyager,
absolutely.
Or Risa.
Well, everything. Whatever. Absolutely everything. Like, I wouldn't even be able to work out where I'd want to go first if I had a holodeck.
You know what's interesting about this scene to me in the holodeck here when his boss comes in? Because most of the time you see kind of a commander-commandee relationship. Mm-hmm. But here, this feels more like a boss-employee relationship. Like they're in a little office environment doing their little research. And he's more like a boss and less like a commanding officer.
Yeah, I do see what you mean there, definitely.
I mean, this happens in the real world. People invite each other for dinner. Your boss will invite you over for dinner. It's very much like a boss-employee relationship.
Yeah, I do get what you're saying because it is a bit different. But I don't know whether that's because maybe they're back on Earth and because they're not on the ship and it's a bit of a different... Because you can't really invite people to your house because...
Yeah, it's like, come to my quarters 20 feet away on the ship.
Yeah, yeah.
ships are like cramped quarters, mm-hmm. except on TNG when it's like a luxury liner. It's, you know, you have to walk quarter mile to get to the other side of the ship in TNG.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's still different from going home for dinner.
Yeah, it is different. Yeah, I mean, I don't know whether it's because it's Barkley and we know that he's fairly unique in a Starfleet context, so...
I love that his boss is trying to be compassionate. His boss knows that he struggles socially. Mm-hmm. Yeah. He's trying to become his friend. He's trying to hook him up with someone. That's really nice.
Yeah.
And the boss is really showing himself to be a caring, compassionate boss here.
Yeah. I think. Well, and I don't know as well whether he kind of... He knows he struggles socially, but I don't know whether it's just because he kind of gets the fact that on the Enterprise he'd gotten comfortable with people. And obviously now he's no longer part of that. He's having a hard time.
It's like the Barkley reset button.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I actually really like all the technobabble in this episode because I really like the science fictionness of Voyager, and Voyager sticks close to its science fiction roots, and I really like that. And I love the problem they're trying to solve. If they need to figure out how to talk to someone across the galaxy, you can't just do it at the speed of light or even just a little bit faster than the speed of light. It's got to be something like a wormhole that allows instantaneous communication. And what a cool problem they're trying to solve. I could totally geek out on trying to solve a problem.
Yeah,
like that.
Well, exactly, because, you know, even though a subspace message can get back to Earth a lot faster than Voyager physically can do, it's still going to be a lot longer than anything even vaguely resembling instant. It's going to be, you know, a longer period of time. I don't know exactly how long. I don't know whether... There's a few places in Star Trek where, you know, time versus... For people to travel versus time for messages to travel is mentioned, but I don't know whether it's anything. I don't know whether it's consistent. I don't know.
Do you follow SETI, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, like using radio waves to try to find extraterrestrial life out there?
No.
See, I do. I even read, there's this this program you can run SETI at home. It's years old now. Your computer can download radio telescope data and use your own computer to process it and send the results back, looking for signs of extraterrestrial life on your own computer. It's really cool.
Oh, that's cool.
It's a resource hog, but I really geek out on that kind of thing. So I love this episode because it solves, that's the same problem. Like, how do you find this, you know, minute little radio signal on the from the other side of the galaxy?
And I like as well, because obviously we get the wormhole idea, which we haven't quite got to yet, but we're going to. But I like the little reference to Deep Space Nine in there. I like we get to Deep Space Nine. That's nice.
What do you think the Midas array is all about? Why is it called Midas? Is that something a reference I don't understand?
I wondered about that, actually. I mean, I know they've made it sort of an acronym, but why Midas? I don't know, because...
The Midas Touch?
The Midas Touch. Know. That's the only thing I can think of where it would be a reference, you know, this King Midas who turned things to gold.
Now, this is one of my favorite scenes in this entire episode, when Barkley is schmoozing with the Voyager crew, and he's, like, their favorite person.
Oh, yeah.
And they're totally selling, like, we can't do this without you, Barkley. Oh, Barkley, glad you're here. How about some holodeck time together, Barkley? When, you know, after
I
we get
really,
off work today.
Actually, I think the next time that I manage to get to a con and I get to talk to any of the Voyager people, I'm going to ask them about this particular episode because I just think they must have had a lot of fun doing this.
I love that he's like, I love the way he's such a physical actor. Like, he's holding this deck of cards and he's shuffling and he's being all, he's not nervous at all. He's being smooth and cool and collected. Yeah. And I love that in this artificial environment, he can be a smooth version of himself, because that's who he really is. And this is how he sees himself. It's a fascinating look inside Barclay's head.
Yeah, well, I think it's just because he's almost cultivated this alternate personality where when he's on the holodeck, he just has more confidence because he knows that there's no real life stakes and that if anything goes wrong, he can just reprogram them to forget that he ever said it and everything. So it just gives him this extra level of confidence. It's just weird, actually. Do you know, it reminds me of, you know, the whole thing with Kira and Odo on Deep Space Nine, when Odo's practicing with the holographic Kira. It just reminds me of that because he's just all smooth and suave there as well. So it reminds me of that a lot.
And real life is totally like this. Like, in different environments, people act a little differently. There's different versions of them. They're like, there's work me, and there's podcast me, and there's social me, yeah. And there's just a lot of different versions of myself. I can totally relate to just having a different persona in a different context.
What is Holodeck Zach like?
You don't want to know. It's classified.
I have to say, I love this bit with the doctor giving the massage, because it's just the beauty of, like, Robert Picardo's ability to just be physical with his hands and stuff.
You know, my back was actually hurting the other day, and I was thinking it would be great to have a holographic doctor. Just boom, where's my, call up my emergency massage hologram, the EMH.
Yeah, definitely. At the beginning of that scene where he's kind of karate chopping Barclay's back with his hands, he's just so kind of over the top with the way that he's doing it. I just love it, and it really kind of epitomizes a lot of what I love about the way that Robert Picardo acts the doctor for me. It really does. It's like, great.
I'm not sure he's actually a licensed massage therapist from no. Looking at the way he conducted that massage.
He's programmed with, like, a whole bunch of techniques, but his way is still best.
It's like, what is that, like Klingon shiatsu?
Yeah. Oh, Barclay going to sleep in his
holographic quarters.
Holographic quarters. And now he's up again.
I actually really I relate to this too. I sleep better in a like a foreign environment, like a hotel room or when I'm on vacation.
I thought you were going to say you sleep better in the holodeck.
I sleep better. If I had a cat named Neelix, I would sleep better with my cat named Neelix curled up on me, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Teach me to play
Show me how to be a Tuvok at Kalto.
It's funny, actually, because in the scene before, I really liked the bit where he said, oh, where's Tuvok? And they said, oh, he's decided that there's no point in playing a game against somebody who's so obviously going to beat him. That just amused me quite a lot.
And this is an obvious little touch, but it's worth calling out in case people haven't noticed. But notice that all the Maquis crewmen are wearing their old Maquis uniform.
Yes.
Because they don't know that they've assimilated into the crew as much as they have. Yeah.
Yeah, that they're in their uniforms and everything. Yeah, I did note that. Yeah, I was going to bring that up. But yeah, it is interesting.
I love that they don't call attention to it audibly. They just put it out there.
Yeah. Yeah, they just put it out there and they don't, as you say, comment on it in any way, shape or form. It's just there and it's just a nice little touch. And I'm sure Suzanne would be very happy to see Chakotay back in his leathers.
Yep, absolutely.
For this episode. So she's not here, so we'll acknowledge that on her behalf.
There you go, Suzanne. There's one for you while you're away.
Yeah. I think this looks really cool.
There are a lot of computer graphics in this one.
Mm, there are. I really like. I always like this. It's like a little Geordie PowerPoint.
Mike Okuda was on point with his Okudagrams for this episode.
Yeah, definitely. I really like how they had Admiral Paris be involved in this kind of whole thing. I really liked that.
It's actually, I kind of wince a little bit when Barclay starts lecturing the Admiral. It's like, when you start lecturing your superiors or lecturing the Admiral, you're headed off the rails, and Barclay is clearly about to jump off the rails here.
Yeah, because he says something as well, which is just like horrendously insensitive. He's not quite said it yet, but I think it's at the end of this scene.
We're forgetting that there's 150 people out there. Right.
I haven't forgotten my son's there. Oh, yeah, well, yeah.
It was a pretty insensitive thing to say to the guy whose son is on that ship. Yeah.
Little bit.
I do think that Admiral Paris is, again, compassionate with Barclay. You know, he realizes that Barclay's struggling. He's saying, let the man talk. And he's not being a slave driver admiral here. He seems like a nice guy.
Yeah.
Despite how Tom Paris has described him for all these years prior to this.
Well, yeah, but then I guess his relationship with his family is probably a lot different from his work relationships.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the guy's probably older now, and I don't know whether, as a result of Tom being gone, he's changed as a person. Like, maybe he has a lot of regrets about their previous relationship because he doesn't know whether he's ever going to see him again. So maybe that's made a lot of change to him.
I think that's the implication. He seems a bit mellower than Tom has described. I have to comment on this. I love Barkley's little fast clap that he does. Little, yes, sir, and he does clap. Yes, sir, exactly.
I know, bless him, he's so excitable.
He is an amazing actor.
Here we go, this is the bit now, isn't it? I have a son of that ship, Lieutenant.
Oh, he's about to snap him down hard here. Oh, at least Barkley's smart enough to realize that he says, I'm sorry. You know, he gets
it. He does apologize. Take the day off. That was not a suggestion. Oh, smackdown.
Yeah, when it's a forced day off, you know, it's like, oh, that's bad. I feel for Barkley, though, because he's trying his best. He really is. No one would accuse Barkley of not caring. That's the thing.
No, exactly. And I mean, I think if you're somebody who struggles to communicate when you have stuff that you know is really important that you need to say, that must be really tough. That must be a very tough thing to have to deal with, to struggle to put your ideas across.
Well, it's interesting because in Starfleet, the lines are blurred, right? It's not just a job because you're an officer in an organization. It's like being in the military. It's not something you do part-time. You're there full-time. So the people you work with in Starfleet, they're not just your coworkers. They're, in some sense, your colleagues, your friends, the people you spend all your time with. And, you know, if you overstep your bounds or say something wrong, you've really stepped in it.
Yeah.
And Barkley has stepped in it here.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I really like how they've had it go dark here, and there's this implication they've been talking for hours.
Yeah, she's like, okay, Barkley, get to the point. What'd you do? Did you apologize? No, I went back to the holodeck. Oh, really, Barkley?
Yeah, I mean, I think she's obviously just so great at what she does, because she has this really great way of kind of having time for people and letting them kind of have the space to say what they need to say, and yet at the same time, when they're just waffling, just cutting through it.
I think she's giving great advice here. She's basically saying, look, you need to not put all this on your shoulders. Don't go back to the holodeck. Don't try to solve everyone's problems. Go relax with your friends and be a normal human being. As a fellow person who tends to put the entire universe on his shoulders, I can totally rate. Sometimes other people have to tell me. What?
I just have to interject because we're 19 minutes in and this is the first time that we've seen Janeway. I don't know whether that's a record.
She's like, I'm not getting a lot of lines in this one, guys.
Well, I think she does from now on in, but yeah, it's quite a while before she shows up.
I was just saying that there are times I need to be reminded, like, okay, you can't actually solve this problem, so don't worry about it tonight.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
And I love that Barkley's the only one who makes sense here. Everyone else is like, we don't understand. Can you explain it to us, Barkley? You're brilliant. Explain it to us. Oh, thanks for such a great explanation, Barkley.
Yeah. It's really cheesy. Like, it's brilliant, but it's super cheesy at the same time. Like, even he must realize how cheesy it is.
It's almost like that episode where we're seeing the Doctor's fantasies.
Yes, Tinker Tanner, Dr. Spock.
Yes, that's exactly what the scene reminds me of. It's like, where's Seven of Nine, and why isn't Seven of Nine making eyes at Barkley?
Yeah, there's slightly less of his, like, competing for his affection. That would have been quite entertaining, actually.
I love this game of catch inside engineering, because I used to totally do this at my work. At my old job, we would, like, take a break at lunchtime. We'd go out and with our baseball gloves and play catch at lunch. And we would talk about work and we'd brainstorm. And this is total. I can 100% relate to this scene.
Yeah. I find it really interesting as well how, because as you said, we've got the Marquis in their uniforms and not in the Starfleet uniform there, that he's imagining Chakotay, like, in other places in the ship rather than being on the bridge. Like, we're seeing him, like, in engineering, and we're seeing him elsewhere. It's kind of interesting. I like
that. He must know that Chakotay is the first officer, though, right? So why...
You would have thought so.
Why is Chakotay in engineering in this scene?
I don't know. Do they?
I don't know.
I don't know.
Because didn't they transmit the ship's logs at this point?
Not yet. I don't think so. I don't think that bit's I think that's at the end when they get to the actual.
You're right. I had been thinking that they had already made contact and transmitted the logs at this point, but they haven't done that yet, right?
They have already made contact, but I forget exactly what it was they managed to transmit, because they had the whole hunters and message in a bottle thing, you know, where they get the letters.
And they sent the doctor.
Yeah.
So the doctor must have given them a basic rundown of what's
happening.
Yeah,
that is true. Yeah.
But this still clearly leaves plenty of room for extrapolation.
Interesting. I'd have to go back and watch the episodes where they have contact to find out exactly what they said to them. But yeah, you'd think they would know that.
Yeah, I'm a little unclear just because I haven't really thought about it in these terms, what the order of operations is. You're like, where are they in the process of, you know, continuing to interact with the Federation and what the exchange of information has been at this point?
Yeah. He's getting a little intense at this point, isn't he?
I love that the boss is totally like, you know, he's clearly a project manager at this point. He's like, oh, I'm not sure we can expend the resources on this, Barclay. And haven't we expended enough time on this already? And, you know, he's taking the natural skeptical position because he's, you know, the organization is being run by him. And he's got to decide who spends time on what. And Barclay's like trying to make his case here as best he can. It's not working.
Yeah. I do like how he kind of goes, I think you need counseling. I liked how... Barclay reacted to that. He wasn't impressed with that as an idea.
Well, he's like, I have had enough counseling over my entire life that I do not need more of that. I need you to listen to me. But Barclay's not doing a great job at making his case gently. Like he's not right. There's this phrase, influencing without authority, right? He needs a lesson in influencing without authority.
Well, yeah, and I mean, as we were saying before, you know, his difficulty in communicating, I think because of the kind of person that he is, it's not, he can't sort of go away with that and think, right, okay, I've got to think of a different way of actually putting this across. He just ends up getting frustrated. And I think that's what we're seeing here, is he's just starting to get frustrated with the fact that he can't really get across to them how important, like what he's, or how much he thinks that what he's got to say has got a chance of succeeding. Like I think he's pretty damn confident at this point that, you know, this is going to work.
What's interesting is Barclay really does know how to do this. Like playing catch with Commander Chakotay in engineering, that will build some camaraderie, right? Mm-hmm. If you took his boss for a walk and said, let's go outside and talk about this, or let's sit down and make a little plan, I'll walk you through my idea, treat it a little more like a human interaction, then he probably would be a bit more successful. But he's making it very adversarial here.
Yeah, he is, yeah. And I think that is just because of the fact that, oh, nice picture of Tom on the
An old picture of Tom from TNG, actually.
Yeah, that
Tom,
is
Tom's
nice.
Twin brother over there in the Next Generation.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, I think it is just because the stakes are higher, I think, when he's talking to real people. And I know that we can have a long conversation about whether holograms constitute real people or not, but that's probably not for now.
I love the way he looks at the picture. He's like, oh, it's my son, Nick Locarno.
See, all we really need to do is just go back to that TNG episode and just replace the name with Tom Paris. We'll be fine.
It is bold of him to go talk to the Admiral.
Yeah.
I think. But he's doing an end run around his boss, and that's not great.
No, but you know what? I don't think he'd normally do this. I think this is actually quite smart of him, because I think what he's doing here is going, well, because this guy's got a personal stake in this, he's more likely, if I say, look, this could work.
It is.
He's more likely to say yes, because obviously, you know, the time, I know money's not really a thing that they're going to worry about, but you know, the time investment for him is he's going to be prepared to invest whatever time, because he's got a personal stake in it.
But he basically rejects him here. He basically says, I can't let my personal feelings, you know, sway my judgment.
He says that, but I don't think ultimately that's what happens.
It's interesting that he says, you know, you've been replicating my son on the holodeck. That's weird and creepy, dude.
Yeah.
It's like, I find disturbing, young man.
I find it interesting because it is mentioned a few times through Star Trek, the fact that, oh, it's not cool to replicate real people. And, you know, we have the whole Barclay thing with Troy in TNG, which is weird and creepy. But I just think it's interesting here hearing it again and seeing that that's actually quite a pervasive attitude, that that's what everybody thinks, you know, that it's actually a really weird, creepy violation of people's rights to do that.
But we don't ever really get clarity on whether there's a rule, a restriction against that, or whether it's just taboo.
I had it in my head that they did say that there was a rule about it, but I don't remember exactly. But that is what I had in my head.
I love that he's trying to get Counselor Troy to go talk to help him. Like, out. Mom, can you come help me talk to the Admiral?
Yeah. Oh, that's almost exactly what he's doing. Although him referring to Counselor Troy as mum would freak me out somewhat, so let's not do that. Yeah. She's just, yeah. She's so worried about him at this point. I think it's really sweet how, despite the fact that what happened in TNG, she could be properly freaked out by the guy and just be like, I don't want him ever anywhere near me.
But yeah, she really hangs in there with him.
Yeah, she does. And she ends up being like a really good friend with him. And I just really like that. It says a lot about her, I think, in the way that she thinks.
That's so important in life, though. Doesn't everyone need someone who just stands by them no matter how crazy they can get?
Yeah. Absolutely. And he's getting pretty crazy at this point.
When the proverbial Neelix poop hits the fan, you need someone who can stick by you.
Yeah. Yeah. And then she just, you know, she agrees to take time off in order to help him. And I mean, wow, that's going above and beyond, I think, really. She really cares about him. She's such a great person. I love Troy.
Yeah, she's clearly developed a kind of special relationship with him as a counselor and as a friend, and the lines have been blurred, but that's okay. You know, I mean, people are people.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think she's wise enough to know that a standard kind of clinical detachment approach here is not going to work with Barclay.
Yeah.
And she cares. She's seen him evolve for years now at this point. At least 5 or 6 years now at this point. Yeah. More than that. More like 10 years probably.
Yeah, I mean, because... Yeah, we're
ways we're towards on, the end of Voyager, and Voyager was after TNG, and what Barclay was introduced when? Season 3 or 4 of TNG? Was, I can't remember.
Yeah, it was fairly...
So we're talking, early-ish. They've been friends for a decade at this point.
Oh, I feel for him here. He's talking, obviously, about how he's no longer got his friends on the Enterprise and stuff.
I know I always draw attention to the subtitles, but I love the subtitle, stammering.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, closed caption subtitles are great.
It is massively amazing that she took time off from the Enterprise. Yeah, like, I'm taking a leave of absence to stay here with you in San Francisco, Barclay.
I think she just realizes that he's got very few friends and that she wants to help him. Like, she really feels sorry for him. I guess being a very empathetic person, you really end up feeling for people like that. Ooh.
Cat meows.
Sneaking out.
Cat meows.
Meow. There you go.
I'm a cat person.
Sneaking out in the middle of the night.
Every time they put cats in Star Trek, I'm all about it because I'm such a cat person.
Yeah, I love cats too.
Oh, see, now he's using his engineering knowledge. He's like, I'm going to bypass the security lockout and I'm going to get back in the holodeck.
I did like it earlier on when she said, oh, we'll have to introduce Neelix to Spot. And I was like, they'll probably just fight.
It's very James Bond here. Well, he's all of a sudden become James Bond. I'm Barclay, Reginald Barclay.
Well, that's the thing, you know, because he is incredibly capable, as we know. It's just... He has better affinity with machines than he does with people.
It's just amazing to me how fast he goes from nervous and awkward to I'm James Bond.
Yeah. Well, because there's nobody there to be awkward with, really. Mm-hmm. When he's just alone with the ship and tech and stuff, he's cool with that. He's fine.
It's like us, you know, we're totally fine as long as we're watching Star Trek.
Yeah. But you know, the rest of the time, nah. Back to his Geordie PowerPoint.
I dare say we're probably fun in real life too.
I'm pretty fun. I like to think so anyway.
There are a lot of interesting visual things in this episode. We've got that cool laboratory, we've got all the Geordie PowerPoints, we've got this cool Midas Array visual. It's very techie episode.
It is, yeah. And I mean, I guess computer
look at all the things
graphics,
they had to make.
Computer graphics, I guess, are getting a lot more advanced by this point.
But it's not even that. Look at all the different console shapes and stuff the wall. There's just a lot of set work they had to do to make this happen.
Yeah, sure. But I kind of wonder whether this is a concept they've had for a long time. Like, it makes sense that this is something that they always had in their mind would happen at some point. So they've probably had quite a while to kind of conceive it and...
And I really do like when they show 24th century San Francisco, because they have to blend all of this modern technology with the remnants of history that you would find in an old city. And same thing like in Deep Space Nine, when they show Sisko's father's restaurant in New Orleans, right? It's like, wow, there's this cool little retro restaurant in the middle of 24th century New Orleans. That's cool.
Yeah, I do like that.
It shows some continuity, like the future's not just transformed overnight. There's going to be stuff from the past that persists. I think it's really interesting. So even inside this lab, it's you know, futuristic, but it's not on a starship. You can tell that. They did a good job of conveying that this is not on a starship. It's some other environment.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, we see Earth so rarely in Star Trek overall. We don't get a lot of Earth. And I mean, I know we wouldn't expect to because they're out in space a lot of the time, but we really don't get to see Earth very often at all through the whole plethora of Star Trek. So it is nice to kind of get a bit more of a feel for Starfleet headquarters and some of the stuff they've got going on there. And it's not just a bunch of old guys in offices. There's actually like loads of tech there as well.
I love that Barclay's like full on like, can't catch me.
Yeah, I know.
Tag, you're it.
It's so funny because he is just like a kid there, isn't he?
Totally. Hide and seek. Let's go.
Yeah, he's great. Just play this game of chase all around the...
I love that he sends holographic Tuvok security officer after the invaders, the intruders.
Yeah, I found it really interesting as well. We haven't quite got to it yet, but there's this bit where... Oh, it's just Tuvok's just saying it now, but where it's like, scan the ship for unidentified people. It's just like, that's how Barclay's programmed it so that, you know, it will work like a proper sensor and stuff.
Right. That's what I'm saying. Everything works like it should on Voyager. There's an actual sense ray. There, you know, all the stuff you would expect to be able to, you know, detect an intruder is functioning as it were. And he really went all out in programming
the really
simulation.
He really did, yeah.
Like, there's holographic sensors to detect real people. That's cool.
Yeah. Yeah, he definitely went all out on the simulation.
So are there actually holographic sensors that are doing the work, or is it just the is it the facilities, you know, the laboratory sensors that are actually detecting that?
I suspect it's probably the lab.
Here come the guys with guns.
Yep. It's fine, B'Elanna's going to shoot them with a holographic phaser. Oh, wait, it doesn't work.
I love that she just stands there looking confused, like, all of a sudden, it's like, does not compute. B'Elanna does not compute.
Why did that not work? You would, though, wouldn't you? If you don't know you're a hologram, because she obviously doesn't.
Yeah, it's, again, every time we have holograms in Star Trek, if it's not an obvious case of a sentient hologram, we don't really know whether they're sentient or not, right? They could be mere projections, or they could be the more heightened, more intelligent holograms, and we don't really know which these are.
Well, I'm assuming they're not the hyper-intelligent ones, because for me, I think that would automatically mean they'd have be self-aware. So I think the intelligent ones know they're a hologram, so I think that's the
I wish I had a better understanding of what the extra special programming is that distinguishes the intelligent holograms from the projection holograms.
I don't know whether there is a fine line. I don't know whether there's a line drawn. I think it would be nice if we could say that there was, but I suspect there isn't.
Like, the Doctor must have some extra special programming that makes him able to be self-aware, where some of these holograms don't have that extra special mental programming.
Well, I mean, maybe programming them to know they're a hologram is the start of it.
Oh, it's like the last line of code. You like code millions of lines of code to write a hologram, and at the end of the lines of code, like the last line is,
you're a hologram.
P.S., you know you're a hologram.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, we see that, don't we, obviously, with the Doctor, and we also see that with Moriarty in TNG, where he becomes aware that he's a hologram and he knows about how he's just in this holodeck. And so maybe there is something in that. I don't know.
Well, that was one. It was one Cartesian line of code, right? It was, you know, be smart enough to beat Data.
Do you get here this sense that, like, Janeway, when she says, "Oh, abandon ship," she's not very vehement about it.
Yeah, usually it's like abandon ship, like, and then there's like red alert klaxons, and then there's people are running everywhere. And here's just like abandon ship, and then they
it's
all stand
very
there.
Very That felt a little bit weird and off for me. Like, I understand Janeway standing there because she's trying to figure out what Barclay's doing, but it just felt a bit weird for me and off.
I'm a little disappointed we didn't get a chance to see the actual holographic warp core breach.
Yeah, I am. Although, I have to say, I think that Seven of Nine is utterly horrible to Neelix here. Isn't she horrible to him?
Well, she's just being mean at this point. Yeah, you suck at singing, Neelix.
Yeah, you suck.
He's like, but I really want to be better. Can you help me? No, you are not able to be... You're not able to be good at this, Neelix.
No, I'm here for my lesson. Oh no, you suck. Like, I'm not going to teach you.
Another micro wormhole.
I like how we get the different Janeway hairstyle as well. Because in Reg's holodeck program, he's got original Janeway hair, and obviously she's got her hair now.
Yep.
I like that.
It had been a while since we'd seen Bun of Steel at this point, so that was fun.
Yeah, but obviously that's how Barclay remembers her, because that's the last thing everybody knew her hair was like. So I think there are some nice touches in here.
Did Barclay not know that Seven of Nine was on the ship? Because she wasn't in his hologram, right?
He wouldn't have done, I don't think, no. Yeah, we really are going to have to think about what they transmitted back.
You know what we should do? We should actually do an episode of To the Journey on this, where we should look at the different episodes where they've communicated and draw out a timeline of that communication, just to clarify this kind of ambiguous point.
Yeah, I definitely think we should do that, because I'm confused now about what's happened when.
Mr. Barclay, our hero.
Yeah.
And Seven of Nine's like, he's a handsome guy. Oh, what? That's only in Barclay's fantasy land. Okay.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. Oh, he thinks it hasn't worked to this point.
They pull the micro wormhole trick a couple times in Voyager.
Yeah.
Like Eye of the Needle, same thing, micro wormhole, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's a cool idea, because you really have this problem of how do you take this basic idea, a wormhole, and continue to make it interesting. Well, there are these micro wormholes, so that's a cool new idea in Voyager.
Yeah, I like it a lot. I don't know whether we have any other instances where they pop up. Those are the two I can think of.
That's part of Voyager's contribution to the taxonomy of spatial anomalies in Star Trek.
Yeah. Oh, she's coming through now.
Oh, this is a weepy moment. You're right.
It is.
I'm not actually going to weep, I think, but I can.
I really love how Janeway here, and actually this is a real nod to Kate Mulgrew as well. I really love how she manages to kind of keep this commanding thing, but she's also, you can just hear the emotion in her voice at the same time.
She does a brilliant job of visually choking back the tears without actually shedding a tear.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, it's brilliant. She's such a talented actress. She's absolutely incredible.
All of the important information here is subtextual. It's not in the words of the script. It's Captain Janeway emoting.
Yeah. Because you would be incredibly emotional there, because this is the first time they've actually spoken to somebody back in the Alpha Quadrant since the start of the show.
It is an historic moment.
Yeah. This is the bit that makes me cry every single time.
You think she would have let Tom say hi at least?
Yeah.
Hi, Dad.
Tell him I miss him. I'm proud of him. Oh,
she's keeping
right
it very official
fields.
And formal, though, don't you think?
Right in the feels.
I think she knows she doesn't have much time. There's no time for, father son chit chat in this brief communication. I get it.
No. Oh, that's brilliant as well. Keep a docking bay open for us. And then the emotion starts to come through a little bit more when she says that as well. That's awesome.
And everyone's like, sorry, we were tools to you, Barclay. Turns out you were a smart guy after all.
And, turns out you just like fixed everything and we suck. Sorry.
At least they say, sorry, we doubted you. But, you know, they could say like, you know, sorry, we, you know, thought you were an idiot.
Yeah. I think it's nice that, you know, in the 24th century, people who, you know, don't necessarily conform with all the social norms, everybody can still appreciate their value.
Yes, and there's not enough
of that, for sure. Yeah.
I think in healthy workplaces there is, you know, you can be quirky and interesting in a healthy workplace.
Oh, yeah, but I mean, generally speaking.
But unfortunately, too many times in the real world, it's a matter of who gets to sit at the cool kids' table.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, and Star Trek tries to avoid that. There's a place for Barclay, even if he doesn't fit in all the time. That's great. Hmm. And they appreciate him.
This is the best bit of the whole episode where they talk about how, we don't know who this Barclay is, but he's definitely a part of our Voyager family now. And I'm just like, oh, the episode's just come full circle. It's just so perfect. This is the kind of thing I love so much about Voyager. Like, it's really cheesy when you think about it, but it gets me in the feels every time. Like, I love it so much.
To the journey. Oh, wait. To Barclay.
Barclay. Yeah, it just gets me. Stuff like this just gets me. I love it. I'm a sap, but I'm a happy sap.
And now he's like, and I've got a girlfriend now, and she's got cats too.
Oh, no. It's like 5 minutes later. Oh, by the way, I have a girlfriend now.
It's turned his whole life around, clearly.
I know.
Look at him. He's looking all smooth again. He's got that look.
All down to Deanna Troi.
He's cocking his head a certain way, and he almost has like a, you know, a swagger to him in this conversation. Look at him.
Yeah.
And she loves cats.
Well, of course she does. Everybody who's like a decent person loves cats, right, Zach?
Well, we don't want to offend our dog loving To the Journey listeners.
No. People can love dogs and cats.
Don't discriminate. People can love fish. People can love ferrets. People can love, you know,
capybaras. Oh, yeah, absolutely. But they just have to love cats as well. That's what I'm saying.
Well, Kay, I have to say this was a great pick for an episode commentary. I have always loved this episode. And we are, as we mentioned previously, gearing up to do an episode where we look at Counselor Troi in her three appearances inside Voyager.
Yeah, this would
be a good segue into that.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that a lot as well. But yeah, I love this episode. I really do like this episode for a whole bunch of reasons. Like, I mean, it's got so much emotional stuff in here. Obviously, the first time that they managed to communicate with... I mean, it's not the first time they managed to communicate with Earth, but the first time they actually physically speak to somebody on Earth in real time. Gosh, that's a big moment after 6 seasons. That is really huge.
And I love that home is just such a theme in Voyager, right? Mm. Not only are they trying to get home to the Alpha Quadrant and to Earth, but they find a way to become a family and a home together on Voyager. And towards the end of Voyager, I think you can really see this tension. They've become a family. Why do they even need to get home at that point? Their home is on Voyager together. And you can kind of see them struggling with that at the end of Voyager's run.
Yeah, because, you know, they've built a home there so much that...
Why would you want to go back?
Yeah, it's like, right. Well, we're going to get back. But actually now this has been a thing for so long that we don't want to give this up either. I always liked the idea that when they get back to Earth, they all live in a big commune.
They just live in holographic Voyager. What are you talking about? They just...
Yeah.
With Barclay. They become roomies.
They could totally do that, couldn't they? That would be amazing. I never thought of that.
So they get back to Earth, and they hook up with Reginald Barclay, and they say, Barclay, we want to recreate this awesome environment we had on Voyager. Can you help us out and make a holodeck program for us? He's like, sure, no problem. I'll move in, and we'll all be roomies.
Yeah. Brilliant. I love it. That's great. And then Troi could come and visit, and they can have chocolate ice cream.
Clearly, I think Troi had evolved at this point as a character, though, because she was much closer to her portrayal of movie Troi than TV show Troi.
Mm. Well, we must have had a bunch of the movies by this point. I don't know exactly which ones. I'd have to actually go back and check, at least two or three.
I'm not sure if I can't remember, honestly, in the moment right now if we've had Insurrection at this point.
Nemesis, I think, was later, wasn't it? So I don't think Nemesis. And we know that Nemesis is after the end of Voyager anyway, because Janeway shows up in it. So... Obviously not all of them, but yeah.
Because Counselor Troi has kind of a different demeanor in the TNG movies. She has a slightly different accent than in the TV show. She has this, you know, the way she carries herself is very different. Of course, she's wearing the uniform instead of the casual wear. So, you know, her character's evolved, and I think her portrayal is much closer to the movie. You know, as you'd expect, because that's when this is taking place. But it's a contrast with Troi we saw in the TV show. I wouldn't mind dwelling on that a little bit. But this is not a TNG podcast, so.
No.
The folks over on Earl Grey can do that.
yeah. But, I just really like how we get to tie Voyager in with the rest of Star Trek in this episode, because that's something that, because of the nature of the Beast, they're so far away from it all that we don't get to see that very often. And when we do get it, it's something that I really like a lot. I think we talked about that a bit when we were doing our episode where we talked about the 8472 simulation.
And it's just fun to tie Voyager in with the rest of the Star Trek universe. You know, Voyager has a tendency to be isolated over there in the Delta Quadrant, and to connect it back up with the larger Star Trek universe is always fun and interesting, and builds canon, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, it does remind you. I mean, I know it's obviously part of Star Trek because of, you know, the way it looks and everything that happens and you know, how it fits in with all the things that have happened before, but I mean, it does still feel in a lot of ways isolated because of the fact that they are so far away. So it is nice when we get to see that connection a bit more strongly. So yeah, great episode for me.
This episode really just drives home how I would say heartful Voyager is, right? This Voyager emotes, I think, in a way that the other Star Trek series don't necessarily, right? This is a very...
It does.
It's kind of a sappy show in a lot of ways. And this is kind of a sappy episode.
Well, I think it is, and I think that's fine.
Oh, yeah, that's why we like it, I think.
If you're somebody that responds well to that, then that's great, and I think it's probably one of the reasons why maybe some people don't like Voyager so much, because they don't really like it that sappy, but I do, so it works really well for me. I think it's a huge part of what Voyager's about, and I think this is a really great Voyager episode, even though we see our Voyager crew an awful lot less in this than we do in most episodes.
If any of you listeners out there don't like this episode, if you don't like the way that Troi and Barclay were brought back, if you don't like the way that that Voyager was situated in the larger Star Trek universe, if you don't like the tone of Voyager in general, I'd love to hear about that because, Kay, you and I both love this episode. We like all of those things. But there's another perspective. There is a group of people out there that do not like those things.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I tend to hear good things, really, about this episode and about Barclay and Troi in general in Voyager, but you know, it's always interesting to hear other people's perspectives.
Well, I think even Barclay, as great of an actor as Dwight Schultz was on TNG, I think he actually really shone as Barclay in this episode. I mean, so much of what he did in this episode I kind of retroactively applied to what he did in TNG.
Yeah, I mean, I think he does get at least one episode in TNG where he's very much the focus of the episode. And then obviously he's in a bunch more. But I mean, obviously he very much is the focus of this episode. This is his episode in a lot of ways. And I think it portrays him in a much more positive light than the episode that's focused on him in TNG does.
It also shows that you don't just flip a switch and magically become, you know, a totally healed better person, right? You know, he is better. He's developed and improved in his social skills in a lot of ways, but he still has the same fundamental core to him. Like, he's evolved. There's no magic switch to make him, you know, the ideal Starfleet officer.
Yeah, sure. And it is great to see mental health issues talked about in Star Trek. And it's great to see people with mental health issues being allowed to be awesome. You know, that's a brilliant, brilliant thing that I think we need to just see more of in general.
I don't think anyone is even close to shaming Barclay for the things he struggles with.
No.
Except maybe when Wesley and Geordi and Captain Picard call him Broccoli.
Yeah, that is true.
That's a little mean.
Although, you know, he's called Barclay, so I think Broccoli's fine.
Any sense people had of you as a compassionate person just went out the window, okay? I'm just saying.
Yeah. But, you know, that's just funny because that's just his name. It's nothing to do with how he is for me anyway.
I do love the Captain Picard, the slip of the tongue and calls him Broccoli as
Broccoli.
Well.
Yeah.
That's embarrassing. That, for Captain Picard, that's embarrassing because Captain Picard does not have, as a rule, slips of the tongue. And that's massively embarrassing.
He doesn't, but then I think, you know, it's one of those, isn't it, where the more you try not to say something, the more likely you are to actually say it.
But that, you know, that kind of thing has to, you know, stick with Barclay. Like, my captain called me Broccoli. Man, yes. Can you imagine? He's going to go home and have a cry fest over that and hang out with his
holographic
cat.
Think he develops a better relationship with them over time, though, doesn't he? Which we see mentioned in this episode anyway. So, but yeah, a great episode. Definitely a favorite of mine. And certainly one that gets me feeling like the Voyager spirit.
I'm looking forward to doing our follow-up on this when we delve into Counselor Troi's appearance in Voyager in general. But that's a topic for another episode of To the Journey. In the meantime, it's been fun talking about Pathfinder together, Kay, and doing a commentary, but this isn't the only thing we've been talking about here on Trek FM this past week. So here's a quick look at some of the other things you may have missed elsewhere on Trek.fm.
Previously on Trek.fm, Literary Treks.
Oh, Matthew, I'm doing just fine. You know, it's always fun every week to hop on here and talk Star Trek books and comics with you. And I don't know if you realize this, Matthew, but this is our 200th episode of Literary... Wait a minute, Matthew. We don't host this show anymore.
The 602 Club.
I honestly was thrilled with the way that they set it up because, like you said, sort of like Russian dolls, I guess, is a good way to explain it. You introduce one character in this existing show, and then it leads to that character's own show, which leads to the next one's own show.
The Edge, a Star Trek Discovery podcast.
There were a lot of comments talking about this roller coaster ride. Mm-hmm. You know, yay, I'm so excited Trek's on. Oh, it's a prequel. You know, oh, I saw the first trailer and I loved it. Oh, Brian Fuller's no longer working on it. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's, we're getting all this diversity. Oh, look at the Klingons, right? And you could just see it. Seriously, some fans have gone through some serious roller coaster rides.
To the journey!
And so I could see the Hirogen viewing themselves as very noble, very civilized. They don't let their prey suffer, but really they're doing these horrific things, just like we do here in the real world when we have to go fight wars.
Yeah, absolutely. I think they go home and they write an epic poem about it, and that makes it okay.
the Hirogen equivalent of Beowulf.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out all of these shows and join the conversation about your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button in Apple Podcasts on your iPhone, iPad, Apple TV, or the desktop iTunes app to get the latest episodes as soon as they're published. And please leave us a star rating and a written review. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Google Play Music, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and most third-party podcast apps. And you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website or grab the RSS link as well.
Well, we always love to hear your thoughts on our shows. And if you have any thoughts on today's, there are lots of ways for you to send them to us. The best place to join in the larger conversation is in the Babel Conference, which is our listeners group on Facebook. If you just type Babel, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field, it should come right up. And if you would like to send us an email, you can use the form on our website at trek.fm/contact, choose message to a Trek FM show and select To the Journey. That will come right to us. And you can also find the network on Twitter at Trek FM and on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm. So, Zach, when you're not replicating some chocolate ice cream for your cat Neelix, where can our listeners find you?
Well, you can find me elsewhere on Trek.fm as co-host of Metatrek's Trek FM show on Star Trek and philosophy, along with my co-host over there, Mike Morrison. You can find me in the Babel Conference if you'd like to talk about Voyager with me there, and you can find me on Twitter. My handle is just my name, at Zachary Fruhling. That's Zachary, Z-A-C-H-A-R-Y, Fruhling, F-R-U-H-L-I-N-G. And how about you, Kay? When you're not busy experimenting on micro wormholes, where can our listeners find you on the interwebs and around the Trek FM network?
Well, you can always find me in the Babel Conference. If you want to look me up on Twitter, my handle there is ChocoWeeble. And you can also now find me as well on Instagram. I've recently joined Instagram. I'm ChocoWeeble there as well. And you'll be seeing lots of pictures of my cats if you want to go there. And probably interesting outdoor things, because those are the main things I take pictures of. So, Zach, do you want to let the listeners know where they can contact Suzanne as well?
Yeah, Suzanne's missing in action. She recently had a baby. She has successfully sought out new life, and she'll be back with us here in a few weeks. But in the meantime, if you'd like to find her on Twitter, you can find her under the Twitter handle, KJaneway8. Well, if you'd like to help us keep all of our shows coming to you each week, we invite you to become a patron of the network through Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, to get all the details. Perks include early access to episodes, exclusive content, producer credits, and many more, all available through our special patrons website, the Patron Zone. It requires a great deal of time and money to produce, host, and distribute these podcasts each month. We really appreciate any support you can give us, and we hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm.
So we have some people that we would like to thank who help us bring to the journey to you every week. C. Brian Jones, founder and publisher of Trek FM and our King Midas. Our executive producers, Matthew Rushing and Ken Tripp. Aaron Harvey, our art director. Richard Marquez, our production manager, and Brandon Shea Mutala, our Patreon manager. And of course, we want to give a big shout out to our associate producers here onto the journey. Bruce Lish, Ju Kim, Richard Marquez, Patrick Carlin, and Norman Lau. Thank you so much for your support of To The Journey and of Trek FM.
Well, be sure to join us next week when we will be reframing our photograph of Nick Locarno. But until then, this has been To The Journey.